Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 resident going into radiology. In today's podcast, we're going to finish up onc pharmacology. I'll just go ahead and say this right off the bat that this particular podcast is super, super high yield because I'm not just going to be talking about the drugs, but I'm going to be talking about a lot of cell biology correlates that they love to test in this context. So I will encourage you to sort of pay attention to this one. And I'll try to work through the material relatively quickly so this is not too long. But trust me, there is a lot of high-yield drugs I'm going to talk about today. So, yesterday we stopped at bleomycin. Remember I said it's the only G2-specific agent. And then today we're going to the next drug class known as the alkylating agents, right? So the alkylating agents. Now, the thing is, these alkylating agents, the key thing you want to remember is that they cross-link DNA, okay? They cross-link DNA. The thing is, I talked about how your anthracyclines, for example, cause intercalation of DNA, where they basically stand in the way of DNA forming bonds. The thing is, in the case of these alkylating agents, by virtue of their mechanism of action, which I will discuss shortly, they cause cross-linking. Cross-linking happens where you basically make, by certain chemical modifications you make to DNA, you make it begin to form like weird bonds, right? So normally like guanine binds with cytosine, but if for example you methylate the DNA, right? Because remember methyl is an alkyl group with an alkylating agent, and then you begin to cause bonds to form between like guanine and thymidine, like a GT bond, then that's not ideal, right? That's what's known as cross-linking, okay? That's how you differentiate cross-linking from intercalation. Intercalation is like, oh, G and C want to form a bond, but you sort of like stand as a middleman and prevent them from bonding. And then cross-linking is you chemically modify DNA so that you begin to have weird bond formation, okay? That's how you differentiate those two. It's actually very high yield to know those key differences. So the mechanism of action of these alkylating agents, right? So basically, the key thing you want to understand here is that guanine has nitrogen on the seventh position, so it's called the N7. When you add a methyl group to this N7 position, again, you can begin to make DNA strands form very strange bonds, like GT base pairs. Now, the thing is, these drugs, in addition to methylating N7, these alkylating agents, there's actually some alkylating agents that also add alkyl groups to the O6 position. Those are specifically the nitrosourureas, because as you'll learn, the platinum agents are all alkylating agents. The cyclophosphamide, diphosphamide, they are both alkylating agents. But these generally do not add methyl groups to the O6, right? All they do is like N7 alkylation. Let me be more specific. But if you want N7 alkylation and O6 alkylation, think about your nitrosourureas. I'll talk about those in a bit. So let's talk about the first group of alkylating agents. We have cyclophosphamide and iphosphamide. Again, they cross-link DNA. The thing is, they need to be converted to active metabolites by the liver. So by like the cytochrome P450 system. So the thing is, if you give a CYP450 inhibitor or the person has liver dysfunction, these drugs will basically not work. And the big, big side effect you want to remember with these drugs is that they cause hemorrhagic cystitis. Please don't forget, right, if they give you a question about a person that's from Egypt that swam in the Nile and then has hemorrhagic cystitis, hopefully you're thinking about schistosoma hematobia. If you see a person that has like pink eye and they have like pharyngitis and they also have like maybe abdominal pain because this bug can cause diarrhea and they also have hemorrhagic cystitis, I really hope you're thinking about pharyngoconjunctivitis associated with adenovirus. Adenovirus can also cause hemorrhagic cystitis. And the thing is, the hemorrhagic cystitis that's associated with cyclophosphamide and iphosphamide, it actually comes from a metabolite that's known as acroline. Acroline is a metabolite of cyclophosphamide, iphosphamide. It is basically a vesicant, right? So if you see the word vesicle, usually means bladder. So a vesicant is something that like basically nukes your bladder. So the thing is, you can try to prevent like free radical damage to the bladder by binding up that acroline metabolite with a drug known as Mesna. Okay, very high yield to know that. Alternatively, you can actually give like very vigorous diuresis, right? So you give the person a crap ton of fluid and then give them Lasix to basically just continuously wash through the bladder. In fact, some surgeons actually go with, some oncologists go with like irrigation, like direct irrigation of the bladder. One other thing that may be unusual that you may see on your exam is the use of this drug, N-acetylcysteine. N-acetylcysteine could potentially be used as well for hemorrhagic cystitis. Now, what do we use cyclophosphamide for? We use it for cancers. We use it for nephritic syndromes. And don't forget that cyclophosphamide is associated with SIEDH, right? So if they give you a person, question about a person that has been taking a cancer drug, and then they have a low serum osmolality and a high urine osmolality, right? Or you can basically say like a euvolemic hyponatremia, right? So like a euvolemic hypoosmolar hyponatremia, think about cyclophosphamide. And then the platinum analogs, again, same mechanism of action, they cross-link DNA, they alkylate the N7 position. The big drugs you want to remember here are drugs like cisplatin, carboplatin, and oxaliplatin. These drugs, they are super nephrotoxic. And the thing is, the metabolite of these drugs that's nephrotoxic is something known as amifostine. So A-M-I-F-O-S-T-I-N-E. Okay, so these drugs, they are super nephrotoxic. Made a mistake there. So the thing is, the drugs, they are super nephrotoxic. They are metabolites that are toxic to the kidneys. You don't need to know exactly what those are. But the thing I want to mention is that you can prevent that kidney toxicity by giving a drug known as amifostine. Amifostine binds up those metabolites so that they don't destroy your kidneys. Now, these drugs, in addition to being nephrotoxic, they are also ototoxic. In fact, I will go ahead and say this. There are certain drugs that are both that are super nephrotoxic and for the most part are also ototoxic. Those are drugs like vancomycin, so they share those two like side effects together. In addition to your platinum analogs, vancomycin has that property. Ethacrynic acid, right? Remember, it's a loop diuretic, right? Remember, your loops work at the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle to inhibit that sodium potassium 2 chloride transporter. So, ethacrynic acid, remember, it's the only loop without sulfur allergy. It also is nephro and ototoxic. And then your aminoglycosides, right? Your 30S inhibitors, they basically kill initiation in ribosomes. Like gentamicin, neomycin, amikacin, tobramycin, and streptomycin. These drugs are also nephro and ototoxic. In fact, you can use them to treat Meniere's disease because you can ablate cranial nerve 8 with those drugs. Now, one big thing you want to know about these platinum agents is that they are associated with really bad chemo-associated MSS, right? So a lot of nausea and vomiting. And the reason is that they're actually agonists at serotonin receptors. So your platinum analogs, very high yield, your platinum analogs are agonists at serotonin receptors, right? And again, if you think about it, right, this drug that you've probably heard of in the hospital, Zofran, ondansetron. Ondansetron is a serotonin receptor antagonist that blocks those serotonin receptors in the chemoreceptor trigger zone, and you use it to prevent chemo-induced nausea and MSS. In fact, if you read the literature, ondansetron was actually discovered from people discovering the serotonin receptor agonist activity of the platinum analogs. Other things you can use to treat chemo-induced nausea and MSS, you can use metoclopramide, right? Metoclopramide will block those dopamine D2 receptors that you can find, again, in that area post-tremor, in the chemoreceptor trigger zone. But also remember that metoclopramide, being a dopamine antagonist, it can cause extrapyramidal side effects like tardive dyskinesia. And don't forget that metoclopramide, right, it can also be used to actually treat diabetic gastroparesis. Because if you remember from the Psych and Neuro podcast, I said that whenever that a chemical equation you should establish in your mind is that there's an inverse relationship between your levels of dopamine and your levels of acetylcholine. If you block dopamine receptors, your levels of acetylcholine will go up. If your levels of acetylcholine go up, you will have, remember, parasympathetic rest and digest, you will have more flux through your GI tract, and you can potentially treat gastroparesis. Remember that erythromycin, which is a motilin receptor agonist, can also be used to treat diabetic gastroparesis. And then one other drug you can use to treat the chemotherapy-induced nausea and MSS is a drug known as aprepitant. So the thing is, there are neurokinin 1 receptors, again, in the chemoreceptor trigger zone, area post-tremor. So you can block those NK1 receptors by giving aprepitant, and that should also, again, prevent or treat chemotherapy-induced nausea and MSS. And then the next group of alkylating agents I'll discuss are the nitrosourease. Again, they cross-link DNA, right? So they alkylate the N7 and O6 positions, right? So like N7, O6 on a guanine, right? And the big drugs you want to know here, they are drugs like carmustine, semustine, they all end in mustine. Although there's a weird one, streptozocin. Streptozocin does Actually, there are two weird ones. The first one, weird one I'll talk about is streptozocin. Streptozocin is a nitrosourea. It's actually used very specifically on exams to treat insulinomas. So if you ever see an insulinoma question, remember Whipple's triad, where people have like hypoglycemia and signs of hypoglycemia, and then their symptoms get better with the administration of glucose. Especially in the context of the MEN1 syndrome, right, as a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor, consider giving those people streptozocin, okay? But the thing is, for the most part, your nitrosourea's, their names end in Mustang, right? I mean, you've probably heard of the mnemonic that you should put some nitro in your Mustang. So again, streptozocin, primarily for insulinomas. These drugs, they are very good for brain cancers like glioblastoma multiforme because they can cross the blood-brain barrier. In fact, I will tell you this. The current standard of care for the treatment of GBM, so glioblastoma, is using these nitrosourea. In fact, I'll say for the most part, people tend to use a drug known as temozolomide. Temozolomide is actually an alkylating agent. But here's where, again, this is not in first aid yet, but it's just one of these cell biology principles that has sort of come out in recent years. And I can almost predict that it will make its way to the USMLEs in a few years. And that's the concept of something known as an MGMT enzyme. So the thing is, the MGMT enzyme is an enzyme that is actually naturally expressed in many cells. And the thing is, if you have a methylation error, it can actually fix that methylation error, right? So the thing is, if you are an alkylating agent and your job is to alkylate, like methylate DNA, for example, and basically form crosslinks, if you are expressing that MGMT enzyme, that's not great for that drug, because that MGMT enzyme will basically undo the effects of the cancer drug. So the thing is, there are actually certain cancers that have an MGMT mutation, where like MGMT is like epigenetically silenced. When MGMT is silenced, then you cannot undo the effects of alkylating agents like temozolomide. So in fact, I'll tell you this, many people that are being treated for GBM, they also get like some kind of testing for the MGMT mutation. If they have the MGM, if their cancer, if their tumor cells have that MGMT mutation, those people will have better effect from getting an alkylating agent like temozolomide. But people that don't have that MGMT mutation, you probably don't want to give them temozolomide because it doesn't really work in that population. Now, the next alkylating agent I'll talk about is busulfan. Crosslinks DNA. Big thing you want to remember again is that it can cause a pulmonary fibrosis like bleomycin. Although remember, bleomycin is the G2 specific agent, right? And then another alkylating agent, I guess probably the last one I'll talk about, is procarbazine. Procarbazine is an alkylating agent, but it also has like an off-target ability to inhibit monoamine oxidase, right? So if you were to take procarbazine with another serotonergic agent, that can potentially increase a person's risk of a serotonin syndrome. I mean, if they wanted to be evil to you on the USMLEs, right, they can say, oh, a patient is being treated with chemotherapy, right? So like they are being treated with procarbazine. And then because of that, they have an immunodeficiency. And then they have like a raging like MRSA infection. And then you give those people linezolid. And then boom, they can get serotonin syndrome from that. Because remember, procarbazine is an MAOI in addition to being an alkylating agent, but linezolid, in addition to being a 50S inhibitor of initiation, is also an MAOI. So those two things, if you give them together, can trigger serotonin syndrome. That'll be a very clever step one question. Now, I guess going to the next group of oncology drugs, we have the topoisomerase inhibitors. Basically, remember, the way topoisomerase works is it relieves supercoils. The way it relieves those supercoils is that it causes DNA strand breaks, does some wiggling around, and then makes those DNA strands come back together. Well, the thing is, these topoisomerase inhibitors, the way they work is that they wait for topoisomerase to have caused those DNA strand breaks, and then after you get the DNA strand breaks, those drugs inhibit the topoisomerase before topoisomerase has the chance to sort of bring reactions together to join those strands back. So if you inhibit the topoisomerase at that point, you still have DNA strand breaks. If you have DNA strand breaks, that can trigger apoptosis of those cells. So that's how your topoisomerase inhibitors work as anti-cancer agents. And the thing is, there are two classes of topoisomerase inhibitors. There are topo 1 inhibitors, right? So like topoisomerase 1 inhibitors. And these are drugs like irinotecan and topotecan. You may say, oh, Divine, how do I remember this? Remember, the I in irino for like the looks like a 1, okay? So just remember it as 1 Renotecan. It inhibits Topo 1. So a Renotecan, Topotecan, those are Topo 1 inhibitors. Your Topo 2 inhibitors, they are called Topo 2 because remember, topoisomerase 2 causes 2 breaks in DNA versus topoisomerase 1 that causes 1 break in DNA. So your Topo 2 inhibitors include drugs like etoposide and teniposide. And again, you may say, Divine, how do I remember these ones? Remember etoposide as etuposide, okay? That will help you remember that it inhibits Topo 2, okay? And if you're going into antibiotic territory, right, don't forget that your fluoroquinolones that can cause a cartilage damage, right? They also inhibit bacterial topoisomerase. In fact, bacterial topoisomerase occasionally is known as DNA gyrase, okay? Your fluoroquinolones are DNA gyrase inhibitors. Now, next drug class we'll go into are the microtubule inhibitors. Your microtubule inhibitors, right? So the thing is, microtubules are like super important, right? You find them in like cilia, in flagella, you find them in neurons, right? So it should make sense that if you're a microtubule inhibitor, you're probably not very good for neurons, right? There's a lot of neurotoxicity. For the most part, peripheral neuropathy, we're taking these microtubule inhibitors. And don't forget, right, from a cell biology standpoint, that your microtubules have a 9+2 arrangement, okay? And remember that you need alpha and beta tubulin to ultimately help you form those microtubules. So there are two classes of microtubule inhibitors, right? You can basically have drugs that can bind to tubulin so that you never have the ability to form a microtubule polymer. So you can effectively say that these drugs are preventing the polymerization of microtubules. This is where your Vinca drugs come from, right? So drugs like Vinblastine and Vincristine, okay? These drugs, by basically preventing the formation of microtubules, preventing the polymerization of microtubules, if you may, they essentially prevent metaphase from happening because you need to build microtubules for metaphase to happen. Okay, so again, these drugs are neurotoxic. They cause peripheral neuropathy because they prevent microtubule polymerization. And remember that anterograde, retrograde transport business from the cell soma in a neuron to like the to the synapse all depends on microtubules, right? So this is why these drugs are neurotoxic. So let me just tell you this right off the bat. If you ever see a question about peripheral neuropathy in the context of a cancer drug on an NBME, always, listen to me right now, always pick Vincristine as your answer. Always, 100% pick Vincristine as your answer, okay? And also don't forget that the drug, one of these drugs that's used to treat a pericarditis and also used to treat gout in some cases, colchicine, also works by preventing microtubular polymerization. Now, your next class of microtubule inhibitors are drugs that prevent depolymerization of microtubules. So basically, these drugs, they essentially bind to microtubule polymers and prevent them from depolymerizing. So if you're thinking about this again from a cell biology standpoint, these drugs will prevent anaphase from happening. Because the thing is, you need to break down that metaphase business for anaphase to happen. But if you hyperstabilize those microtubules and they never depolymerize, then you'll never have anaphase happening. That's how this second class of microtubule inhibitors work. And these are your taxanes, right? So drugs like paclitaxel and docetaxel. Again, these drugs have peripheral neuropathy as a side effect. But I'm telling you, like, if you do an NBME exam, you should always go with Vincristine if that option is presented to you. So you may say, Divine, how do I remember that Vinca alkaloids prevent microtubule polymerization and your taxanes prevent microtubule depolymerization? Here's one thing that has always worked for me. Just remember one, and then you remember you take the opposite for the other. And to remember one, I even have a mnemonic for that. I just remember VP, like vice president. So the V is for the Vinca alkaloids and the P is for preventing polymerization of microtubules. So that's a mnemonic that may help you there. Okay. Now, the next anti-cancer agent I'll talk about is ATRA, so all trans-retinoic acid. This is mostly used to treat your acute promyelocytic leukemias, right? Remember, your acute promyelocytic leukemia, it's a kind of acute leukemia, right? And it's associated with that fancy-schmancy 1517 translocation, right? Remember that you'll see hour rods on an exam. If they were to present this kind of cancer to you, remember those hour rods, they can trigger DIC, right? So the thing is, if you have that 1517 translocation, you have a lot of buildup of promyelocytes, and promyelocytes still have the property of cell division, right? And the thing is, if you have a cell that can divide, that's not good for cancer, because cancer cells, what do they love doing with their lives? They love to divide. So The thing is, if you can give an agent that will cause these promyelocytes to differentiate terminally to myelocytes, you basically cause them to differentiate to a cell type that has no further ability to divide. That's where all transretinoic acid comes in. ATRA is basically like, think of it as a transcription factor assistant, okay? It basically makes those cells differentiate down to myelocytes, and then once they become myelocytes, they cannot divide any further, and boom, you've basically stopped the cancer from growing, okay? So that's how all transretinoic acid works. Now, the next drug I'll talk about here is a drug known as bortezomib. Bortezomib. This is a very high-yield drug that's beginning to make its way to the US MLEs. Why? Because you can actually use it to treat multiple myeloma. So let's talk about the mechanism of action of bortezomib. But before we do that, we need to take a small detour into cell biology territory. Now, what's this small detour? The thing is, there's a transcription factor that actually promotes the proliferation of certain cancers. This transcription factor is known as NF-kappa-B. Okay, so that's the first fact. NF-kappa-B is a transcription factor that promotes the proliferation of certain cancers, like multiple myeloma, for example. Now, the thing is, there is an enzyme known as I-kappa-B that has the ability to inhibit this NF-kappa-B, which is clearly a good thing, right? If you have a ton of I-kappa-B, you'll inhibit NF-kappa-B, and then you don't promote the proliferation of cancers. So, the thing is, the problem is I-kappa-B is broken down by proteasomes in the cell, okay? So, think about it. If your proteasomes are just working like a lot, like, or you're overexpressing proteasomes for some bizarre reason, you'll keep breaking down I-kappa-B, you'll never inhibit NF-kappa-B, and the cancer will proliferate. So, for these cancers that upregulate proteasomes, again, they keep breaking down I-kappa-B and you don't have that inhibition. So, the thing is, the proteasome has many subunits. One of them is a 20S subunit. The thing is, bortezomib has the ability to inhibit the 20S proteasome subunit, right? And if you inhibit the proteasome, right, you basically prevent the breakdown of I-kappa-B. If you prevent the breakdown of I-kappa-B, I-kappa-B will persist for longer periods in the cell. And then you will then have the ability to inhibit NF-kappa-B, and you basically stop that cell proliferation. So that's how bortezomib works as a treatment for multiple myeloma. Another treatment you may see on exams is thalidomide. Thalidomide, that thing that causes phocomelia, is also used for multiple myeloma. But you may say, oh, Divine, why would you give thalidomide to a person that has multiple myeloma? Well, the thing is, multiple myeloma is primarily a disease that occurs in old people, right? Old people are not necessarily trying to have kids. People like in their 70s, for example, right? So giving them thalidomide, you're not really concerned about that. If you're sort of comparing the risk reward, the reward is better, right? Because you're also treating the multiple myeloma. Now, the next drug I'll talk about is imatinib, right? So let me just go ahead and establish a principle for you right now. Any drug that ends in nib, okay, is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. I'll just settle that for you right now. If you ever see a drug and it ends in nib, like imatinib, dasatinib, or erlotinib, whatever, it's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So, imatinib is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, but it's used to treat CML, right? So, CML, remember, right, is that, again, fancy disease, Philadelphia chromosome 922 translocation, right? You form this BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase. And because that tyrosine kinase is constitutively active, you have like aberrant proliferation of cells. So you can use imatinib to inhibit that BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase and you're good to go. Now, because they know everyone has memorized imatinib for CML, they're also beginning to introduce imatinib on US MLEs as a treatment for GI stromal tumors, right? So like GIST tumors. The thing is, GIST tumors express a tyrosine kinase that's known as c-KIT. It's very high yield to know that for exams. So that c-KIT tyrosine kinase, you can also inhibit it with imatinib. Now, the next drug class I'll talk about, I'll talk about both together, that's erlotinib and cetuximab. Erlotinib is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, right? Cetuximab is a monoclonal antibody against the receptor I'm going to talk about right now, actually. So, the thing is, there are a few lung cancers that express like abnormal EGFR genes. Okay, they express abnormal EGFR genes. If you want to be like super specific, that's like the ERB B1 receptor. Okay, the ERB B1 receptor. Please don't confuse the ERB B1 receptor with the ERB B2 receptor. The ERB B2 receptor is the thing that is also known as the HER2 new receptor in a certain breast cancers that is targeted by trastuzumab, which I'll talk about in a bit. But EGFR gene ultimately helps you express ERBB1, okay? And the thing is, ERBB1, right, is a tyrosine kinase receptor. And one high-yield cell biology correlate here is that ERBB1 actually works through KRAS as a second messenger system, okay? So ERBB1 is the receptor. It's a tyrosine kinase receptor. It works through KRAS. Again, very high-yield to know that. It works through KRAS as a second messenger system. So why is this important? The reason this is important is that you can block, because let me make things a little clearer. ERBB1 acting through KRAS promotes cell proliferation. And you know that this is something that cancer cells will want to take advantage of. So if a person has a cancer that overexpresses ERBB1, you can give a tyrosine kinase inhibitor to either block the receptor, right? And that's where erlotinib, E-R-L-E-R-L-O-T-I-N-I-B comes in. Or you can give a monoclonal antibody against that ERBB1 receptor. In this case, a cetuximab. So, why do you think I went through all the trouble of mentioning KRAS as a second messenger in this system? Well, think about it. If you have a cancer that has a mutated KRAS, then you will not respond to treatment with erlotinib or cetuximab. So why is this important for your exam? Well, this is important for your exam because guess what? Colon cancers, right? Many of them, or at least a decent number of them, have those KRAS mutations, right? So if you read First State, you probably remember something known as the adenoma to carcinoma sequence. The mnemonic that people used to remember it is like AK53, right? So first you have an APC mutation, and then after that you have a KRAS mutation, and then after that you have a P53 mutation. That's where AK53 comes from. So if you have a KRAS mutation, block the receptor, the upstream ERBB1 receptor all you want, there's nothing's gonna happen, right? So I can envision this as a step one question where they talk about a person that is taking erlotinib, cetuximab, they are not getting any like tumor response, right? Think about a KRAS mutation as the potential inciting event there. So again, that's why colon cancers, they're not very responsive to these agents. Now, the next drug I'll talk about is trastuzumab, right? So trastuzumab, you've heard about this before. It's a monoclonal antibody against the ERBB2, okay? That's also called HER2-NU. It's commonly expressed in many breast cancers. So trastuzumab blocks that receptor, right? So that you can basically decrease the growth of the breast cancer. Although, the thing is, yeah, it's good that, I have a drug that can kill ERBB2. The only problem is that having an ERBB2 overexpression in breast cancer is actually a bad prognostic factor. That's actually a high-yield factoid to know for exams. So one of the ways trastuzumab works, right, so this is where they can bring in immunology on your exam, is that it works through something called ADCC. ADCC stands for antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, okay? Don't forget that IgG and I believe IgE and C3b also have the ability to do ADCC, okay? So trastuzumab, right, one of the ways it works is through ADCC, right? So let's sort of talk about how trastuzumab may use ADCC to kill a cancer cell. So the thing is, trastuzumab, for example, could bind to the breast cancer cell, right? And then because trastuzumab is an antibody, the constant region can be bound by receptors on the surfaces of certain cells, for example, like the natural killer cells, right? So if that constant region binds to a receptor on the surface of a natural killer cell, to be more specific, actually, the receptor it binds to is CD16. Remember, CD16 and CD56 are the cell markers for NK cells. So you bind to the CD16 receptor on natural killer cells. When you bind to that receptor, you basically have the natural killer cell then beginning to release a lot of perforin. And that perforin can go and perforates the cancer cell, and then the granzyme goes into the cancer cell, activates caspases, and causes apoptosis or cell death of those cancer cells. Okay, and one key thing you want to remember with trastuzumab is that it can cause dilated cardiomyopathy. In fact, the classic question is patient that is being treated with chemotherapy for breast cancer, and then the ejection fraction goes down. Right? Think about trastuzumab. Also think about your anthracyclines, because it so happens that anthracyclines, right, so like doxodonorubicin, also used to treat breast cancer. Another way they can word this question is they can talk about a person that has breast cancer, HER2 new mutation, and then they say, prior to starting trastuzumab, what is the next best step in management? This is probably more of a shelf exam or a step 2 CK or step 3 question. But what they can do is they can say that, like you probably need, I'll say for the most part, before these drugs are started on people, oncologists tend to get echocardiograms on these people, right, to like estimate their EF, so that, oh, if their EF is like 50% before they started the drug, and then you now notice that, oh crap, their EF is now 40% 6 months later, you should know at that point that maybe I should probably stop this drug and maybe try some other agent for this cancer. So again, trastuzumab causes dilated cardiomyopathy. The dilated cardiomyopathy associated with trastuzumab, though, is reversible. When you stop the drug, the cardiac function comes back. Contrast this with your anthracyclines, right? So like donorubicin, doxorubicin, these drugs cause dilated cardiomyopathy, but it is irreversible, right? So you basically have like permanent systolic dysfunction, although you could potentially have prevented this by giving a drug known as dextroxazine. Dextroxazine is an ion chelator, so you basically inhibit that Fenton reaction that is promoted by the anthracyclines. Now, the next cancer drug I'll talk about is rituximab, right? So rituximab is a monoclonal antibody against CD20. So basically, right, because CD20 is found on essentially every B cell, it's very good at depleting a person's B cell population. And it's very high yield to know that rituximab, one of the mechanisms it uses in its anti-cancer business is actually ADCC. That's why I described ADCC in the context of trastuzumab. Now, on an, I guess, unrelated note, EBV, right, Epstein-Barr virus, and remember, it's one of the herpes viruses, it uses CD21, right? That's why it infects B cells for the most part. It uses CD21 to infect B cells and macrophages. Now, the next cancer drugs I'll talk about are your aromatase inhibitors, right? So like drugs like anastrozole, letrozole, exemestane, right? So anastrozole, letrozole, exemestane. So the thing is, basically, if you want to convert androgens to estrogen, you use an enzyme known as aromatase, right? So if a person has an estrogen responsive malignancy like breast cancer, for example, if you give an aromatase inhibitor, you prevent the formation of estrogen and you basically make that cancer cell not get like growth signals, so you can treat the cancer that way, right? So again, aromatase helps you convert androgens to estrogens, right? So if, for example, you're going from androstenedione to estrone or from testosterone to estradiol, aromatase makes that happen. Now, what's the primary use of aromatase inhibitors on MBMEs? The thing is, you can use these drugs for like breast cancer, chemoprophylaxis in postmenopausal women. It's actually high yield to know this point, not in premenopausal women, postmenopausal women. Why is that? The thing is, in premenopausal women, the primary source of estrogen is the ovary, right? Aromatase inhibitors are not going to do squat for you under those circumstances. But if you're postmenopausal, the primary source of estrogen is, guess what? Your adipocytes, your fat cells. And fat cells express a crap ton of aromatase. So giving an aromatase inhibitor under those circumstances is a very good idea, okay? And the thing is, in general, you want to try avoiding like aromatase inhibitors, again, in premenopausal women, because it can cause very severe, like, hot flashes, right? So, like, these, like, menopausal symptoms. So, again, premenopausal women, breast cancer chemoprophylaxis, go with tamoxifen. Postmenopausal women, breast cancer chemoprophylaxis, go with anastrozole, your aromatase inhibitors. And the thing is, your aromatase inhibitors, because they actually decrease the formation of estrogen, they actually have like a lower thromboembolic risk and a lower endometrial cancer risk compared to tamoxifen. But because they are depleting your pool of estrogen versus tamoxifen that has like some estrogen agonist activity in bone, your aromatase inhibitors actually have a pretty high risk of like joint pain and arthralgias and also like osteoporosis. Okay, that's actually a pretty high yield factor to know there. Now, next cancer drugs I'll talk about are the close cousins of the aromatase inhibitors. So these are drugs like tamoxifen and raloxifen. Okay, so these drugs are SERMs, right? So they are like selective, what does a SERM even stand for? So selective estrogen receptor modulator. So these drugs, they are used in, again, premenopausal women for breast cancer or chemoprophylaxis. And what are the key things you want to know about tamoxifen, right? So you want to know how it works by tissue type, right? So in the breast, tamoxifen is an estrogen receptor antagonist, so it's great for breast cancer, right? But in the uterus, tamoxifen is an agonist, is an activator of estrogen receptors, right? So you actually have people have an increased endometrial cancer risk if they take tamoxifen, although it's not a very significant risk, but it's significant for MBME exams, okay? So I would encourage you to know that. But in the bone, tamoxifen actually also activates estrogen receptors. So it actually decreases a lady's risk of osteoporosis. In fact, this is one of the reasons why its close cousin, raloxifen, is used for the treatment or the prevention of osteoporosis. But that's in like a very select population of individuals. In general, if a patient has osteoporosis, you probably want to put them on a bisphosphonate. Okay. Now, one other thing you want to know about tamoxifen is that it is actually more effective at preventing breast cancer if you compare with raloxifen, okay? And again, because it has like estrogenic properties, you can have a thromboembolic disease, right? So like DVT, strokes, PEs, if you're taking a tamoxifen. Now, let's compare and contrast tamoxifen with raloxifen, right? So the thing is, raloxifen in the breast, it's an estrogen receptor antagonist, but not as powerful as tamoxifen at that business. So that's why raloxifen is not as effective in preventing breast cancer. But in the uterus, and here's where things are different, raloxifen is an estrogen receptor antagonist. So it actually has no increased risk of endometrial cancer compared with tamoxifen that has an increased risk of endometrial cancer. And then in the bone, raloxifen is actually an estrogen receptor agonist, okay? So you can actually use it to prevent or treat osteoporosis. And then I guess the next drug I'll talk about is a drug known as fulvestrant. Fulvestrant, F-U-L-V-E-S-T-R-A-N-T. It's an estrogen receptor antagonist. You can actually use it to treat like certain gynecological malignancies. And then the next drugs I'll talk about are leuprolide and goserelin. So leuprolide and goserelin. Goserelin is G-O-S-E-R-E-L-I-N. These are GnRH analogs. Key thing you want to remember, right? If you give GnRH analogs in a pulsatile fashion, that will upregulate the HPG axis. But if you give your GnRH analogs in a continuous fashion, that will inhibit the HPG axis, right? So these drugs, if you give them continuously, that will inhibit the HPG axis. And then cancers that are responsive to outgrowths of the HPG axis will no longer grow, right? So like you can use them for like prostate cancer, for certain gynecologic malignancies, and you can actually also use them to shrink fibroids, right? So like leiomyomas. So usually before a person like goes for leiomyoma surgery, right, you can actually give like leuprolide for like 6 months to like decrease the size of the fibroid by like 50%, okay? And then the next drugs I'll talk about like flutamide and bicalutamide. So they all end in amide. So flutamide, bicalutamide, they are like androgen receptor antagonists. You can use them to treat like metastatic prostate cancer. And then the next drug I'll talk about is like finasteride, dutasteride. Just think of them primarily as being used to treat BPH, but they sort of go with these drugs I've been talking about, so I'll just mention them here. So the thing is, finasteride, dutasteride, they are inhibitors of an enzyme known as 5-alpha reductase. So why do we care? The thing is, 5-alpha reductase helps us convert testosterone to a more like supercharged form of testosterone known as DHT, dihydrotestosterone. It so happens that DHT is like the primary thing that promotes the growth of the prostate, right? Promotes the growth of the prostate. So if a person has BPH and they're having significant symptoms, you can try to kill the growth of the prostate by effectively decreasing the amount of DHT in the body. And one very effective way of doing that is by inhibiting 5-alpha reductase with drugs like finasteride and dutasteride. You inhibit 5-alpha reductase, you decrease the formation of DHT, and in the long term, you can significantly shrink the prostate under those circumstances. Now, one other thing I will say with that is, finasteride, dutasteride are used for the long-term treatment of BPH. But if you want to like immediately help BPH symptoms, you want to give an alpha-1 blocker, right? So you want to give drugs like tamsulosin, right? You can also give like a prazosin, doxazosin. They are alpha 1 blockers, but remember that prazosin, doxazosin, alpha 1 blockers, both at the bladder neck, right? And at the blood vessel level, right? So they can cause like orthostatic hypotension. So if you want something that's a little more specific for the prostate, right, like the bladder neck around the prostate, you want to give tamsulosin. Tamsulosin works on alpha 1 AD receptors, which are only found around the bladder neck. And don't forget that tamsulosin can also be used to treat nephrolithiasis, because again, by blocking those alpha 1 receptors, you open up the bladder neck. And people also say, if you read the literature, that it can dilate ureters. So that can help you basically drain a kidney stone. And then the final drug I'm going to talk about is a clomiphene. So clomiphene, the big thing you want to know is that, I mean, think about it. Clomiphene sounds eerily similar to tamoxifen or raloxifen, right? So clomiphene is actually a SERM, okay? The only thing is that it's more of a partial agonist at estrogen receptors, right? So think about it. If you're a partial agonist, in the presence of full estrogen, you're effectively acting as an antagonist at those estrogen receptors, right? So the thing is, clomiphene is used to treat PCOS because by basically being an antagonist in the brain, right, like more upstream, right? So like in the hypothalamus, for example, you can basically remove that negative feedback of estrogen. So you have like more GnRH pulsatility, and that can promote fertility in the setting of a PCOS, right? So basically, if a patient has PCOS, they're trying to get pregnant, just give them clomiphene, and it helps in a great majority of cases. Okay, so that's where I'm going to stop. And that's officially the end of Onc Pharmacology. I know today was kind of a lot. I probably talked about like 20, 30 different drugs today, but I promise you, this is a very high yield, podcast. In fact, I'll probably, when I'm putting this on my website, I'll probably call it like a cell biology podcast as well, because there's a lot of high yield cell biology stuff that could be tested from this, and also from episode 70. And then before I sign off, just want to again throw this out there that I offer tutoring for step 1, 2CK, 2CS, step 3, medicine in training exams, and also the medicine board exams. And I also prepare applications and help with interviews for like med school and for residency, so like ERAS and AMCAS. So if you know anyone that needs any of those things, or feel free to send them my way. I've done this for hundreds, probably like a couple thousand of people, so I'm pretty conversant with this. So just send them my way. The email is Divine Intervention Podcasts, so podcast with an S, at gmail.com, and I can sort of point them in the right direction. So have a wonderful day. I am super glad the Lakers won yesterday. I am really hoping that we beat the team we are facing tomorrow. We beat the Jazz, and then I keep climbing up that Western Conference table, and then win the NBA Finals, and everything will be all right with the world. So I'll see you guys in the next podcast. That'll be episode 72. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and God bless. Thank you.